On the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. The Great Methodist Leap Forward on Marriage Equality, Pro-Gay Preachers Challenge Uganda, and Sarah at CPAC. That's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio.
Conservative all-stars headlining this week's CPAC convention.
It has always been part political convention, part pep rally.
Like Woodstock for right-wingers.
CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. It's a generous effort to provide MSNBC and Jon Stewart with a week's worth of programming. But it's also a crucible for the conservative campaigns and priorities that are most likely to dominate the headlines for the rest of the year. Writer Sarah Posner was at this year's CPAC last weekend, and she will be with us to share some of her impressions.
I'm grateful to report that the matter concerning the Reverend Dr. Thomas W. Ogletree will not result in a church trial.
When the United Methodist Church removed the Reverend Jimmy Creech from ministry 15 years ago, they did not silence him. In fact, they freed him to speak even more loudly about the essential need to invite all people, LGBT people included, to experience the love of God and to affirm the relationships of people of faith, LGBT people included, in the church. One Methodist bishop took steps this past week to move beyond the church's era and trial methodology on the issue. I'll talk with Jimmy Creech about how far we've come and about how much farther there is to go. But first,
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni signed a bill into law that increases punishment against gays. Supporters say this law reflects the moral value of the vast majority of Ugandans, but critics argue that it gives legal cover for the trampling of human rights.
The Reverend Dr. Amos C. Brown is the longtime pastor of the Third Baptist Church in San Francisco and president of the San Francisco NAACP. Since his days as a student of Martin Luther King Jr. at Morehouse College, Amos has devoted his life to the prophetic struggle for justice. Because, tragically, organized religion has played an intrinsic role in fostering Uganda's anti-gay environment, many State of Belief guests have told us that the only effective voice to counter the hate mongering will be a religious voice. And that's why Dr. Brown's current campaign is so essential. That's why I'm so happy to be able to welcome him back once again to State of Belief Radio. Amos, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be a part of your program.
Amos, what is it that you're doing to organize faith leaders with respect to Uganda?
I just simply reminded them of what Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement stood for principally, for life, liberty, and respect for the worth and dignity of all humankind. And I feel that it is incumbent upon African-American faith leaders and civil rights leaders to not become that which they hate. We hate racial prejudice. We have been against the injustices that have been perpetrated against blacks ever since we were brought here as slaves. And we must be morally consistent and not cherry-pick what we deal with. I think that we should have the same kind of prophetic utterances about the recent legislation in Uganda as we did regarding apartheid in South Africa and the injustices that were perpetrated against Nelson Mandela for his having been incarcerated over 27 years unjustly by that racist regime. I have gotten 40 faith leaders, among them Obama Ambassador Andrew Young, Dr. Joseph Lowry, President Emeritus of Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. Warren Ott at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Dr. Judith Scruggs, President of the National Baptist Convention, the largest predominant African-American faith community in America, and Dr. Thurston of the National Baptist Convention of America, Dr. Baltimore, of the Progressives, and many others have done the courageous thing of taking a stand on this matter. And we're calling for, if Uganda does not follow President Obama's lead, is asking for them to rethink this matter and back down, repeal it. If they do not, I think we should call for sanctions against Uganda. The same as we call for sanctions against South Africa. We just got to be consistent and show that we are principled.
Amos, do you have or do your friends and you know relationships with religious figures inside Uganda that can be helpful in trying to turn this tide to protect LGBT people in that country?
Unfortunately, many of the faith leaders have been schooled and tutored by conservative friends groups, evangelical friends groups, and I have documentation of this, who have so impacted, developed control over the faith leaders in Uganda. We have sent our statement to the ambassador of Uganda, the United States, and we're waiting for their response.
And when you're talking about evangelical leaders who have messed with their minds and put up a roadblock on this, you're talking about conservative evangelical leaders from the United States meddling in the minds of Ugandan leaders?
Definitely. Many leading evangelical preachers 3 years ago went to Uganda, and they went there under the guise of dealing with the issue of AIDS, which was a noble thing. However, they got sidetracked and started moralizing about the gay lifestyle and whipped those Ugandans up into a frenzy over this matter.
You know, Amos, why do you think it's taken so long for faith leaders in America to organize around this issue?
Well, for one thing, we have too many evangelicals in America, and many of them are African Americans, who have really been on the wrong side in my estimation on this issue. They've called for the impeachment of President Obama. They've called for the resignation of Attorney General Holder because he stands for gay rights and human rights and civil rights. We have sown the seed here in America for this kind of hate and divisiveness on the gay community. That's all.
You know, Amos, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I don't think those people like you. I know they don't like what we've been saying on this show. Does that bother you?
Not at all. I've been in this struggle since I was 15 years old in Jackson, Mississippi. And Mecca Evers was my mentor. I organized the first youth council of NAACP in the state of Mississippi after the murder of Emmett Till. And I was touched by that as a child, that his life was not valued. His dignity was not respected. And I think that it would be immoral and wrong for me to look the other way in the face of people in Uganda talking about taking away life and liberty from people who have not bothered anyone else. You remember that during the days of the Nazi occupation in Germany, Hitler went after the Jews because they were different. He went after also the gays. And we cannot be silent in the face of any public policy measures and any preachment that demean and put down people because they are different.
Amos, I know that some of our listeners are hearing you and saying, is there anything we can do to help?
Yes. First of all, they can appeal lovingly with their faith leaders, their pastors, their bishops, to join us in signing on to the statement. We want to get a minimum of 1,000 signatures from around the world appealing to Uganda to back off of this measure. My email address is Dr. Amos C. Brown, that's DrAmosC. Brown, at thirdbaptist.org. Dr. Amos C. Brown, at thirdbaptist.org.
You know, Amos, this is all getting presented in what claims to be religious language, and you and I both know that this isn't about good religion.
It's bad religion. You remember Negro's slaves saying, have you got good religion? This is bad religion, and it should cause us great concern that two-thirds of the African nations have anti-gay sentiments and legislation. Mm-hmm. And I feel a lot of this is born out of a lack of information, of being conditioned by oppressive fundamentalist theology that came principally from people of the Western world who went to Africa. Remember Jomo Kenyatta said, when the missionary movement came to Africa back in the 19th century, the missionaries had the Bible and the Africans had the land. But when they left, the missionaries and the imperialists had the land, and the blacks were left with distorted, erroneous interpretations of Christianity and the Bible.
Hmm.
That's the seed of this problem.
Yeah.
This is where it's coming from.
Have you had any success in talking effectively or even openly with any of the evangelical leaders in this land that are going abroad and peddling this hate?
Well, to his credit, Rick Warren did backpedal on this matter.
Mm-hmm.
He was over there at the same time these persons were there.
Right.
And when they came up with this measure of calling for capital punishment for gays and also life imprisonment, he and Reverend Rodriguez did issue a statement. But it takes a collective group. It takes a movement to deal with it.
Right.
One or two individuals, not enough.
Yeah.
We need to establish a movement.
The Reverend Dr. Amos Brown brings a half century of civil rights activism to his defense of every human being here and abroad. Amos, your tireless ministry for justice is always inspiring. I will sign that and will encourage others to. I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I have the same sentiment about you, and I thank God for all the great work that the Interfaith Alliance has done to break down barriers in the faith communities around the world.
CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, is an annual event that brings together the luminaries of the right and helps hone the conservative message for the year ahead. Especially in election years like 2014, it's a bellwether of what we're likely to see in terms of messaging priorities and prominent voices. Journalist Sarah Posner attended part of the conference this year, and she has, as always, written incisively about that and about a new film that was screened for those present, one that may suggest that religion will continue to play an inappropriate role in the campaigns ahead. And I am so happy to have Sarah Posner back with us on State of Belief Radio. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Welton. It's nice to hear your voice.
I know that even with Obamacare, your health insurance limited the amount of time you were allowed to be at the conference. But what were you able to witness in your time there?
Well, I spent a full day and evening there, and I saw a lot of political speeches, including by Rand Paul, who won the straw poll there, indicating the attendees' support for him for the 2016 presidential nomination. I saw speeches by Rick Perry and Ralph Reed and Mike Huckabee, all of which were inflected with religion, of course. But the thing I wrote about was, as you mentioned, this movie called Persecuted, mm-hmm. which is about an evangelist named John Luther, who is framed for murder and hunted down by the government.
Now, I want to get to it in just a minute, but first of all, I know you've done this before.
Yes.
Do you make any observations this time about the general tone of this year's conference compared to what it's been in other years?
It was much more libertarian than other years, I think. And I think that there were parts of the conference that really highlighted the tensions between social conservatives, who are still an essential part of the Republican base, mm-hmm. and the growing libertarians represented by Rand Paul and his father, Ron Paul, who wasn't at the conference, but their ideology is represented by those two figures. And I think that the conference participants were much more comfortable discussing the tensions between these two movements and also the places where these two strands of the conservative movement might find some common ground.
What was the audience like, Sarah?
There were a lot of young people there. There was quite an age range, I would say, you know, from high school or college age students to retirees. Mm-hmm. And I would say that they were very receptive, particularly to the libertarian type messages of someone like Rand Paul. They were very receptive to discussions of, say, criminal justice reform, which to me was sort of a new topic to be brought up at CPAC. Speakers critical of the war on drugs and incarceration rates for minor drug offenses, things like that. They're definitely moving in a direction where they're looking to sweep into the big tent the conservative activists who were mobilized by the Ron Paul movement.
Yeah.
But there's still some tension there, and I think particularly some tension with people who you might not see at CPAC, but mm-hmm. you might see at the Values Voters Summit, for example.
So, sometimes, Sarah, I've thought that everybody was angry. Did it seem that way this time or not?
Well, yes, regardless of whether they're in the libertarian camp or the social conservative camp. They're definitely angry about Obama, you know, and all the terrible things he's done to restrict everyone's liberty.
Yeah.
So that's definitely an applause line
sure.
for everyone there.
Sure.
To me, I felt like it was a little bit low-key in terms of the anger, or maybe I'm just getting more inured to it. I'm not sure.
Well, I want to get to this this film. You wrote about Persecuted for Politico. Tell us about that film.
Well, it's a independent, rather low-budget sort of film that was written and directed by Daniel Lusco, who's made a couple of films that you've probably never heard of, but was very interested, he told me, in what he called the timeless themes that were represented in this movie. And to him, they may be timeless, but I think to the conservative movement, they're very timely, mm-hmm. because I think that this really plays into both the concerns of the libertarian wing and the social conservative wing, that the religious liberty of Christians is under siege by a government that is seeking to force them to comply with secular laws, such as the contraception coverage requirement under the Affordable Care Act, or as we've seen in the attempts in states like Arizona to legislate a religious exemption to same-sex marriage laws, for businesses, that is, not for clergy.
Yeah.
So I think that even as you see libertarians embracing same-sex marriage, particularly younger ones,
mm-hmm.
you're also seeing sympathy from their camp for the religious right argument that the government is trying to restrict their religious freedom as they express opposition to same-sex marriage or to covering contraception or abortion or what have you.
Sarah, does Persecuted refer to Christians?
Well, it claims to refer to anyone, but the protagonist is a Christian. He's an evangelist, a very popular evangelist named John Luther. There's no symbolism there, I imagine. And he is persecuted by the government because he refuses to endorse a piece of legislation that, quote unquote, makes all faiths equal. Now, you think that in the United States of America, in the eyes of the government, all faiths are equal. But what the movie is trying to depict is that the government is trying to force everyone into this compelled ecumenism, and that would force him to deny the truth of what he preaches. The movie opens with him refusing the request of the Senate Majority Leader to publicly endorse this piece of legislation, after which the Senate Majority Leader orders what turns out to later be the Secret Service to drug Luther, frame him for the rape and murder of a 16-year-old girl, and then attempt to assassinate him.
What a great view of government.
And I'm telling you, people in the audience after the screening told me that they thought that it was very credible and very believable, particularly, in their words, under this administration. So this is what people at the Conservative Political Action Conference think of the Obama administration.
Sarah, I'm going to restrain myself from talking about his understanding of persecution. But I'm even more concerned about how he defines the constitutional guarantee of religious freedom and why all of those people were applauding for something that obviously doesn't square with the Constitution.
Right. I almost felt watching it that the suggestion was that this is akin to the Establishment Clause, right? I mean, because the Establishment Clause prohibits the government from endorsing one particular religion. And the Free Exercise Clause, in tandem with that, protects everybody's right to practice their own religion, right?
Right.
So a piece of legislation that would dictate something about one faith versus the other would obviously be unconstitutional, but what they're suggesting is that what the evil government wants to do is to declare all faiths to be equal, which it already has.
Right.
You know, so it's just a very strange conception, like you said, of religious freedom, of the Constitution, and particularly of what constitutes persecution and what is a plausible plot line for what the United States government might do to an evangelist.
There were several speakers at this year's CPAC, Sarah, who actually urged conservatives to not vote for religiously pure but unelectable candidates rather than just support conservative enough figures who can actually win. Is there a little bit of concept of compromise back on the table?
I think that there's an acknowledgement that some of the very far religious right candidates that the Republican Party has had of late are not helpful to the Republican brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they don't want a Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch. They probably don't even want a Rick Santorum. They want somebody who can win. And so I think that they know that they can't win without the support of the religious right.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to find some balance there. This is some balance that they've been trying to find for numerous election cycles.
Right.
I think that someone like Rand Paul, who's not really thought of as a religious right figure, but is still, you know, anti-abortion, anti-choice, and very much is willing to play the religious liberty card.
Yeah.
I think someone like that can be that kind of crossover candidate for them, who the religious right would trust because of what he'll say about religious liberty and who the libertarian wing already likes.
I see. Sarah, your work is just too broad for us ever to be able to just stick to one topic. You've written a lot about Pope Francis. This week marked the first anniversary of his ascendance to the throne of St. Peter.
Mm-hmm.
What stands out for you about the first year?
What stands out for me is how much the media loves what they think Pope Francis is. And I think that he's still a bit of a mystery because I think the media has read into things that he has said that are not particularly clear, but offer a hint of perhaps some more open-mindedness than we've seen in the past two popes. And the media eats it up.
Sure.
This could not have been better PR for the Vatican if they had tried, and I do think they actually did try. Now, that's not to denigrate Pope Francis. I think he has said some really powerful things, particularly about the global economy and global economic inequality. But I think that people are far too willing to read into things he says, say, about LGBT rights than he really intends or is capable of changing in church doctrine. Mm-hmm. The real story to me about Pope Francis is how the media has covered him rather uncritically. And I think that there's a lot of discussion among Catholics about what his apparently off-the-cuff comments about many things actually mean.
I see. Sarah Posner is a prolific journalist whose work appears regularly in Religion Dispatches, The Nation, and many other publications. Her report from CPAC was published in Politico. Sarah hosts a popular program at bloggingheads.tv, and she's the author of the book God's Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, we just don't ever have enough time, but I am so glad you were on today. Thank you.
Thank you, Welton.
Just before we go to break, I want to think back to a year ago this past Thursday after white smoke lofted out of the chimney over the Sistine Chapel in Rome, and the announcement was made that a new pope had been elected. The cardinal from Argentina who had been chosen would be known by the name of Francis, Pope Francis, Francis, as in Francis of Assisi. We should have known, but how could we have known? This man's choice of a name based on reverence for an ancient saint would be a different kind of pope, a Catholic leader who would give a new face and a new disposition to Catholicism. Not long after his election, people around the world, Catholics and non-Catholics, recognized a fresh voice of hope, a man uninterested in judgment but fixated on mercy, a Catholic leader who would return the church to priorities of social justice in a manner that has been absent for decades. Now, I don't have to tell listeners to state a belief what this pope has done for the world of religion. Personally, going to the poorest and weakest among us, embracing people of all faiths and people of no faith, washing the feet of women, listening compassionately to the voices of Muslims, and demonstrating in daily behavior the importance of moving away from a world focused only on affluence and power. What's happening inside the Vatican, I don't know. I hope there's rejoicing. What will happen to this pope? I don't dare guess. But in this moment, the one-year anniversary of the term of the new pontiff, I know affirmation of this man is in order and gratitude for his demonstration of faith in action through compassionate words and deeds. My heritage is in the historic Baptist tradition, not to be confused with the identity of the largest Baptist convention in the United States. Across the years, Catholics and Baptists, though sharing persecution in an early denial of religious liberty to them, have sometimes been highly critical of each other. As a Baptist, I know only one term that captures my view of Pope Francis, and that term is brother. Happy anniversary, Brother Francis. Jimmy Creech has done passionate work for an inclusive United Methodist Church that didn't begin with officiating at that same-sex union in 1998 that cost him his status as a minister, and it certainly didn't end with that event either. As co-founder of the organization Faith in America, Jimmy has continued his activism, traveling the country and speaking about the urgency of excluding no one from the message of a loving and welcoming God. The United Methodist Church has just seen one bishop take a decisive step in a positive direction, and the one person I wanted to talk to immediately was Jimmy Creech. And Jimmy, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. It's wonderful to be back with you.
For listeners who may not have heard about Bishop Martin McLee's action, I wish you would just summarize what the excitement about it is.
Well, the Reverend Dr. Thomas Ogletree celebrated a wedding for his son and his son's spouse. It's the same gender wedding back in the fall of last year. And charges were brought against Dr. Ogletree. And there was actually a trial scheduled for earlier this year. Bishop Ives was presiding for the trial, and he decided to postpone the trial with the hope that there could be what is called in our tradition a just resolution between the church and Dr. Ogletree rather than there being a trial. This week it was announced that a just resolution had been reached between the United Methodist Church and Dr. Ogletree, and so there would be no trial. And following that was the announcement by Dr. Ogletree's bishop, Bishop Martin McLee, that he would, from now on, not put clergy on trial for conducting same-gender weddings, even though there is a law within the United Methodist Church prohibiting clergy from doing so. It was a momentous and historic decision, I think a courageous and prophetic one on the part of Bishop McLee. The just resolution itself was wonderful because it allowed a process to move forward without a clergy person being put on trial and the potential of having his credentials taken from him.
Jimmy, how then does this impact other pending court trials?
It really does not, not officially. It only applies to this particular trial. As far as I'm aware, there are no outstanding charges against other clergy for conducting same-gender weddings. Now, there may be something in the process where a charge might be brought, but at this point, I don't think there's an outstanding charge. So it doesn't impact any judicial process that's in place. There are clergy who have conducted very publicly same-gender weddings and are likely to have charges brought against them. But those clergy are in other annual conferences around the country, and the bishops who preside over those annual conferences may not follow Bishop McLee's example.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, actually, whether or not there's any inevitability that other bishops will follow Bishop McLee, or whether in some instances it will harden someone else's attitude and they'll say, well, we're sure going to keep doing this.
I think that's accurate, actually. I think the Council of Bishops within the United Methodist Church are divided on whether they are supportive of clergy who conduct same-gender marriages or not. And so I think there are a number of bishops who are really becoming emboldened to take a stand against putting clergy on trial. And so there will be some who will very strongly support Bishop McLee.
Yes.
There will be others who strongly disagree. In the south, the southeastern part of the United States, you know, there's a strong opposition to same-gender marriage and, and to really including same-gender-loving people. In the Northeast and on the West Coast, there's a much greater openness to including same-gender-loving people. And so there is a regional factor here. I think that there are bishops who recognize that a great deal of harm is being done to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people by the policies and actions of the United Methodist Church, particularly when pastors are put on trial for affirming and supporting the loving relationships between, of same-gender couples. And these bishops are no longer going to sort of stay hidden in the closet of the council. They're going to take a step out, and they're going to be leaders, and they're going to do things like Bishop McLee has done. Bishop McLee has essentially opened up a process of dialogue and communication and conversation that a trial cuts off. A trial doesn't produce anything except punishment. And there's no resolution in a trial. It's simply an act of punishment, with Frank Schaefer being the prime example just most recently. So I hope that Bishop McLee's example will lead others who are not perhaps ready to step out and take a stand against the policies of the church, but are willing to be in dialogue. I hope that there are some bishops who will follow that example.
Jimmy, let me be personal for a moment. You've been fighting this battle for so many years. How does it make you feel to see finally a glimmer of hope?
Well, it's exciting. I just recently realized how long it has been since my first trial, and that was in 1998. It's been 16 years. It's hard to believe. And, you know, what I sometimes think, why has it taken so long for someone to take the position that Bishop McLee has taken? The rule against clergy conducting same-gender weddings is no more wrong today than it was when it was passed in 1996. It's always been wrong. It's always been a harmful and destructive law. Why has it taken so long? On the other hand, I celebrate the fact that finally it's happening. I think it's happening now because we have, you know, like I think 17 states now where marriage equality is either provided or recognized. And same-gender couples are stepping forward, and they are very publicly wanting to join themselves together in marriage, and they want to do it in the context of their faith and their religious community. And clergy can no longer say, you know, oh, I just can't do a union ceremony for you. You know, this is something else. This is a legal marriage, legal recognition, a legal commitment. And clergy are, I think, being moved now to say, this is a part of what I'm called to do. This is a part of my ministry. Yeah. And they can't turn their back on it any longer. And I think the bishops are beginning to recognize that. And the bishops themselves, like Bishop Talbert, who has conducted a same-gender, actually union, it was not a legal marriage, but a same-gender union, he stepped out and he took that leadership. I think the time has changed, the context has changed, and the reason it has is because of the courage of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people who've been willing to let their families, their friends, their colleagues, church members know who they are and understand the integrity and dignity of the life they live together in singles and in married and committed couples.
Jimmy, do you remember the very first time the issue of homosexuality came up in your ministry?
Specifically, I do, yes. It was a Wednesday morning in 1984. I think it was in May, just after news had been published in the local newspaper that the United Methodist Church had passed a new rule saying that, and this is the language of the church, self-avowed practicing homosexuals could not be ordained or appointed within the United Methodist Church from now on. And a member of the congregation I'd known for 3 years came into me with great agony, crying and pouring his heart out to me to tell me he was leaving the church. He was in his late 40s. He had been a member all of his life, and he was leaving. And he came out to me at that point. He was the first person who ever self-identified as gay to me and began to tell me what it was like to be gay in the church and in society, and how harmful and painful it was to be told by his church that he, because of whom he loves, was less moral, less human, had less integrity and dignity than those who are not gay. It was because of the integrity and dignity that he had, and I knew him to have for over 3 years, that compelled me to reexamine my own beliefs about homosexuality and then study the church's position and then begin to challenge it. He made the difference in my life, and I think other lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people who have the courage to let themselves be known all make the same difference in the lives of others.
I really do thank you for sharing that. Now, how would you contrast that moment with the present one?
I refer to my friend as Adam. It's not his real name, but I began to get into some conflicts and have some controversy around my ministry a few years later because of my advocacy, very public advocacy for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. And he called me up one day to apologize for coming out to me because he knew that that was the moment that had changed my life and my ministry, and I became a strong advocate. And he pledged to me that when he could retire, he was a professional person, an educator, he could not come out publicly. He said, when I retire, I'm going to become a gay rights advocate because I want to make this world better and safer for my sisters and brothers who are lesbian and gay. Hmm. He died a year later of a heart attack. And I really wish Adam could be here today to know about marriage equality being a reality around this country, that the Supreme Court has ruled that same-gender couples cannot be denied their rights, that federal courts around the country are saying constitutional amendments denying same-gender couples their rights are unconstitutional. I just wish Adam could be here. It's a new day. It's a different day. There's still much more work to be done, but there's certainly reason to feel confident that one day lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people will be fully accepted, not only in the church, but in society, affirmed and celebrated as the people of integrity and dignity that they are.
Jimmy Creech is a pioneer of inclusivity in the United Methodist Church, having paid the price of his ordained ministry for his convictions. Since 1999, he's led the organization Faith in America and speaks widely on issues of faith and justice. You would do well to read Jimmy's autobiographical book titled Adam's Gift, a memoir of a pastor's calling to defy the church's persecution of lesbians and gays. I thank you, as I do always, for you coming to State of Belief Radio and sharing your thoughts and message with us. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you so much, Welt, and blessings on you.
Now, before we go, on March 10th, Ben Carson, who had spoken at CPAC over the weekend, brought his logic to an annual event called the New York Meeting. During his talk, Carson made reference to Americans now living in a Gestapo state. After the event, the good doctor was asked if he had meant what he said.
I mean, very much like Nazi Germany, and I know you're not supposed to say Nazi Germany, but I don't care about political correctness. You know, you had a government using its tools to intimidate the population.
Oh. So which do I start with? The utter obscenity of conflating a genocidal regime that slaughtered 6 million Jews and many others in the name of patriotic fervor with our pluralistic, free, and open society? Or the staggering disingenuousness of making that conflation while, by that very act, at that very moment, enjoying the boundless and unfettered gift of free speech that we're all blessed with? Carson then used the same words that he had shared with the adoring CPAC audience to condescendingly describe what he sees as being wrong with America today.
We now live in a society where people are afraid to say what they actually believe. And it's because of the PC police, it's because of politicians, it's because of news. It's all of these things are combining to stifle people's conversation. The reason that is so horrible is because the only way that you have harmony and reach consensus is by talking.
Yes, doctor. Real Americans are terrified of cheering you at public speeches, lauding you in blog posts, sharing videos of your insights on YouTube, singing your praises on Facebook. You are being silenced because the PC police or something. Somehow, there is an enormous population of Americans who've come to see the tiny inroads of minority privilege in this country as a staggering blow to their every God-given right. Actually, I don't know what could be further from a Gestapo nation than one that welcomes this obscure medical person to address a national prayer breakfast and criticize the President of the United States to his face, that broadcasts his paranoid and hateful words, all spoken with a benevolent smile at the preeminent conservative conference in the nation's capital, that offers him a platform to denigrate the suffering of an entire Holocaust of victims. Hitler wouldn't even acknowledge Jesse Owens. America can't get enough of this guy. Carson says there's not enough talking going on. Really? Really? At last year's CPAC, Carson used his time at the podium to strongly imply that President Obama was making conscious decisions intended to hurt America. And what happened to him in this Gestapo state of his fevered imagination? He got invited back again this year. Friends, something very, very bad is happening in some formerly respectable corners of the conservative establishment. This relentless messaging of persecution, of unfairness, of oppression is raining down on otherwise rational conservatives. An Orwellian paradigm of intolerance is freedom, help is harm, and power is victimization is taking ever stronger root. The only thing I can ascribe it to is the win-at-all-costs mentality that Newt Gingrich first spawned during his time as Speaker of the House, a mentality that continues to bounce around the right-wing echo chamber like a demented pinball. But as Dr. Carson's unfortunate obsession with Adolf Hitler should remind us, there are ways of winning that guarantee that everyone loses. Fanatical, madman wannabe leaders will always be among us, but they are nothing without their followers. And so today, I'm not asking our conservative friends to join the ACLU, buy a Prius, and march for marriage equality. I'm just asking, is this really who you want to follow? Do you really, truly not believe that you can help take the country in the direction you think is best without the likes of Dr. Ben Carson? Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue they can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us throughout the week using Facebook and Twitter. The listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show, encourage them to listen too. We'd love to hear from them. Join the conversation. Bring more to the table. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.